Please join me in a moment of prayer. Holy and gracious God, you call us to be light for your kingdom. So bless us by your word that we might know that truth that sets us free. Amen. I need to begin this morning's sermon with an apology to two women who I suspect none of you know. Ethel Carlstrom and Olive Zoller. You see, when I was a still wet behind the ears pastor back in Phoenix in the late 1980s, I was teaching Bible class one Wednesday morning, and we got into this conversation about sermons and what sorts of things are helpful for hearers of sermons and what sorts of things aren't helpful. And it came to pass that morning in the context of that conversation that those two women made me promise, pinky swear even, that I would never, ever, ever preach a sermon about golf. You see, the fellow who was the senior pastor of that congregation at the time, every couple of months, he would weave a golf illustration into the sermon. And Ethel and Olive couldn't relate, because never in their lives had either one of them ever played golf. And they just plain didn't like it. And thus they made me promise that when I was doing time in the pulpit, that I would never, ever, ever preach about golf. But more about that later. You see, this morning's gospel lesson is a familiar one, isn't it? The Beatitudes, those opening verses of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount as recorded in the Gospel according to Matthew. In fact, this morning's Gospel lesson is the one part of the Gospels that is authorized by the curriculum developers of the state of California as being included as an example of Jesus' teaching in junior high textbooks across our state, paid for with our tax dollars. So if this text is familiar to our students at JM and Stanley and OIS, it ought to be familiar to us. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the children of God. And so on, and so on. Those words are so familiar, so peaceful, so calm and inviting and encouraging that even the state want you to know them. Until that is, you stop and think about them and consider what it is that they assert and contemplate what a life lived into them would really look like. Actually, one only needs to get one word into these Beatitudes to begin to feel uncomfortable with them. Think about that first word, blessed. Or is it blessed? Blessed sounds so pious and religious and otherworldly, doesn't it? In fact, we've taken when we read these Beatitudes to pronouncing that word differently when we read it here than any other time we use it in the course of our day-to-day speech. Blessed, we say when we read it in the context of the Beatitudes, whereas most of the rest of the time we just say blessed. So like last night when Steph Curry was being interviewed after the Warriors-Celtics game, he was wearing a knit cap that had a logo on it that said B-L-E-S-S-E-D. Was Steph subtly asserting that he was blessed? Or that he was blessed? in either event, that word, which in Greek is makarioi, which we translate as blessed, is in most every other context interpreted and translated as fortunate or happy or privileged, as in the privileged recipient of divine favor. And I'm not so sure that many of us, or maybe even any of us, would say that people who are persecuted or reviled or mournful or hungry or most of those other words are privileged. No? I mean, seriously, whom do we call the privileged in our society? The wealthy, the well-to-do, those who win the lottery, the healthy, those with intact nuclear families, those whose kids and or parents and or spouses truly appreciate them, those with clear skin, those with a different winter coat for each day of the week, those who don't have trouble getting pregnant, those whose biopsies come back negative. In fact, most of the world defines privileged as having to do with being graced with an abundance of limited resources, be it power or money or success or wellness or abundance of some sort or another, of having something that other people aren't so lucky or blessed or fortunate or privileged to have. But as true as it is that all good things around us are gifts from the one true God, I'm not thinking that Jesus has this in mind when he starts voicing out those statements we call the Beatitudes. Let's face it, folks. These behaviors and attitudes which Jesus describes at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount as being avenues of blessedness, they aren't the sort of things, honestly, that most of us aspire to, are they? Really? We don't want to have to mourn the pain of our losses. We don't want to have to mourn the injustice and the hurt that happens to others. We don't want to be poor in spirit, acknowledging that we can't do it ourselves and that our help and our salvation must come from God. We don't want to be meek, patiently waiting for God's time to come. We don't want to be peacemakers because that might well require that we insert ourselves into some uncomfortable or awkward or dangerous situations. We don't want to be persecuted for righteousness' sake because we know that the powers of this world will work hard to keep the world unjust. Speaking against injustice can get you into harm's way or worse, after all. But that's okay. Because it seems to me that these blessing statements in the Beatitudes are less about intentionally setting our minds on becoming mourners or persecuted or poor in the spirit than they are about recognizing that God is present in the midst of the worst situations in the world. In those situations that we might call God forsaken. You see, in a certain way, these Beatitudes are a reminder that people aren't truly blessed because of their success or their wealth or their power, their particular abundance of limited resources, but rather they are blessed, that we are blessed, because God chooses to be with us and for us. Now, maybe it bugs me and me alone, but it seems to me that a whole lot of well-meaning preachers and theologians down through the years have done the Church of Jesus Christ a huge disservice by misreading and misapplying this thing we call the Beatitudes. I can't tell you the number of people whom I've heard or seen or read who have misappropriated these words of Jesus. Think about it this way. You know what the difference is between descriptive speech and prescriptive speech? Descriptive speech, as it applies to human behavior, tells us what is going on. Prescriptive speech tells us what you should do. Descriptive speech says you're driving 20 miles an hour over the speed limit. Prescriptive speech says you should try driving 20 miles an hour over the speed limit. Descriptive speech is about describing what's going on. Prescriptive speech is about prescribing what should be going on. But what happens here is that for years and years and years, the church has read these Beatitudes prescriptively. We've used them as a prescription for how to get a good life. Problem is, they become a suffer fest. Be sad, be poor, be sorrowful. Put yourselves into positions where you invite persecution and suffering and sorrow and accusation to rain down upon you. Try like the Dickens to be the most downtrodden person in the world, and God will bless you. Anybody aspire to that? On the other hand, if we read these words descriptively, they become this beautiful series of promises about how God promises to be with people in pain, about how God is willing to work through the simple and the downtrodden, the brokenhearted. What we've done is we've taken these beautiful promises of God, these amazingly beautiful promises of Jesus, these descriptions about how God is with us even in the worst times in our lives, and we've turned them into a guilt trip because we've twisted them from being a description to being a prescription. But what does this all have to do with golf? Actually, this. How many of you have ever tried to hit a golf ball? Okay? How many of you have ever tried to hit a golf ball hard? Right? You get up there and you think, now I can hit this ball. I've got to hit it hard. Right? Is this true of me, or is this maybe true of some of the rest of you? If you try to hit a golf ball well, you may hit it hard. If you try to hit a golf ball hard, will you ever hit it well? Let's ask Bob Wyand, the local expert in the room. Bob, have you ever tried to hit a golf ball hard? Has it ever worked out well? Thank you. Oh, I can't tell you the number of times I've been some hole on the golf course trying to figure out how I'm going to hit it hard and let it rip, and inevitably it's either a worm burner or it's 85 yards to the right. That's just what happens for me. Occasionally, if I try to hit it well, I may hit it hard. Occasionally, not often. You see, if hit the golf ball hard is understood to be a description of something that may well happen, then hearing it could put a smile on my face. But hit the golf ball hard as a prescription, that's going to get me into nothing but trouble. Similarly, if we understand these Beatitudes of descriptions in which the ways our lives may be blessed by the Lord our God, then we hear them the way Jesus intended them to be heard. as words of promise and comfort and gospel and good news. But if we take these Beatitudes as prescriptions about how your life ought to be lived, there's nothing good about the news that they bring. Make no mistake about it, folks. These words of Jesus are good news. My prayer is that they might be good news for you. Amen.